This is the fourth day of this November 2007 7-day Sesshin. And I'm going to resume with the reading from Hakuin, but I'm going to switch books now. The one that I read from the first 3 days just went on and on. I thought enough about this false Zen, and the Buji Zen, and so instead I'd like to now read from another Hakuin text, and this one is called The Zen Master Hakuin, and it's was translated by Philip Yampolsky a long time ago. Roshi Kaplo read from this book at least 10 sesshins, 15 sesshins maybe. I could read some of these passages by heart, but it's very strong stuff in here, and I found, I'm going to read his autobiography. It's a whole different type of teaching where he's not denouncing whatever forms of false Zen, but he's speaking of his own very rough, painful practice. It's in a chapter here just called Supplement. It's the supplement to a chapter called Orate Gama 3. And he starts off from when he was a boy. He said, "When I was 7 or 8 years old, my mother took me to a temple for the first time, and we listened to a sermon on the hells as described in the Myo-mo-ho-shi-kwan. The priest dwelt eloquently on the torments of the hells of wailing, searing heat, incessant suffering, and the red lotus." And there's a footnote here. Listed here are 3 of the 8 hot hells. In popular Buddhism, which is accessible to many common people in Asia, the hells serve to they offer a kind of religious background to the Dharma. It's people who have practice in the West in contemporary times will not have heard much about the hells, but it was a big thing in Hakuin's time, and in a little town where he grew up, it was something that left quite a mark on him. He goes on, "So vivid was the priest's description that it sent shivers down the spines of both monks and laymen and made their hair stand on end in terror. Returning home, I took stock of the deeds of my short life and felt that there was but little hope for me. I did not know which way to turn, and I was goose flesh all over. In secret, I took up the chapter on Kanon from the Lotus Sutra and the Dharani on Great Compassion," that's our Dahishin Dharani, "and recited them day and night. One day when I was taking a bath with my mother, she asked that the water be made hotter and had the maid add wood to the fire. Gradually my skin began to prickle with the heat and the iron bath cauldron began to rumble. Suddenly I recalled the description of the hells that I had heard, and I let out a cry of terror that resounded through the neighborhood. From this time on, I determined to myself that I would leave home to become a monk. Hey, whatever it takes. You know. To this, my parents would not consent. Yet I went constantly to the temple to recite the sutras and to study the works of Confucianism. At 15, I left home to become a monk, and at that time I vowed to myself, even if I should die, I will not cease my efforts to gain the power of one whom fire will not burn and water will not drown. Day and night I recited the sutras and made obeisance to the Buddhas, but I noticed that when I was ill or taking acupuncture or moxa treatment, the pain I felt was just as it had been before. Moxa treatment is, some of you know, is where you burn a kind of incense and hold it near the skin, and it's supposed to increase circulation. And I've heard that it actually can be effective. I was greatly depressed and said to myself, I became a monk against my parents' wishes and have yet to make the slightest progress. He still, at his young age, was imagining that enlightenment would mean that you, if you held your hand over a fire, you wouldn't feel heat, wouldn't feel the burn. He goes on, I have heard that the lotus is the king of all sutras, venerated even by ghosts and spirits. People who are suffering in the lower worlds, when they rely on others in their efforts to be saved, always ask the Lotus Sutra be recited for them. When one considers that recitation by others can save a person from suffering, how much more effective must be recitation by oneself. There must indeed be profound and mysterious doctrines in this sutra. Thereupon, I picked up the Lotus Sutra and in my study of it found that, other than the passages that explain that there is only one vehicle and that all phenomena are in the state of nirvana, the text was concerned with parables relating to cause and effect. If this sutra had all these virtues, I said to myself, then surely the six Confucian classics and the books of all the other schools must be equally effective. Why should this particular sutra be so highly esteemed? My hopes were completely dashed. At this time, I was 16 years of age. When I was 19, I happened to read it's a Chinese name, but it's a collection of biographies of 74 famous monks, in which the story of how Master Yan Tao was killed by bandits and how his cries at the time resounded for over 3 miles is described. This Yan Tao is Chinese, of course, and in Japan, he's known as Ganto. I wondered why such an enlightened monk was unable to escape the swords of thieves. If such a thing could happen to a man who was like a unicorn or phoenix among monks, a dragon in the sea of Buddhism, how was I to escape the staves of the demons of hell after I died? What use was there in studying Zen? What a fraud, Buddhism! How I regretted that I had cast myself into this band of strange and evil men. What was I to do now? So great was my distress that for 3 days I could not eat, and for a long time my faith in Buddhism was completely lost. Statues of the Buddha and the sutras looked like mud and dirt to me. It seemed much better to read lay works, to amuse myself with poetry and prose, and thus to a small degree alleviate my distress. I just need to say that I, from my admittedly unprofessional point of view, it seems to me that the case could be made that Hakuin suffered from bipolar disorder. So much of his writings are so extravagant and wildly passionate, and there are other things about him and his whole style that suggest he was vulnerable to manic episodes, and maybe what we see here is the other side of that, the depression. When I was 22, I went to the province of Wakasa, and while attending lectures on the Shu Dong Lu, I gained an awakening. Later, when I was in the province of Iyo, I read the such and such and achieved an intense awakening. I concentrated night and day on the Mu Koan without a moment's rest, but to my great disappointment, I was unable to achieve a pure and uninvolved state of undistracted meditation. Equally disappointing to me was the fact that I could not achieve the state where waking and sleeping are the same. The spring of my 24th year found me in the monks' quarters of such and such, pursuing my strenuous studies. Night and day I did not sleep. I forgot both to eat and rest. He said here, studies, but we can be sure that this was not just him studying. He was training. He's practicing. I forgot both to eat and rest. Suddenly a great doubt manifested itself before me. It was as though I were frozen solid in the midst of an ice sheet extending tens of thousands of miles. A purity filled my breast, and I could neither go forward nor retreat. To all intents and purposes, I was out of my mind, and the Mu alone remained. Although I sat in the lecture hall and listened to the master's Taisho, it was as though I were hearing a discussion from a distance outside the hall. At times it felt as though I were floating through the air. So you could, it sounds to me like a certain deep samadhi state, but not yet awakening. And I have to wonder about him, these two experiences he referred to while he was reading. He called the first one an awakening and the second one an intense awakening. But it's hard to say, you know, with the translation, given the fact that he was still struggling with the Mu Koan, maybe that wasn't what we would call awakening. Anyway, this state lasted for several days. Then I happened to hear the sound of the temple bell, and I was suddenly transformed. It was as if a sheet of ice had been smashed, or a jade tower had fallen with a crash. Suddenly I returned to my senses. I felt then that I had achieved the status of Ganto, who through the three periods of time encountered not the slightest loss, although he had been murdered by bandits. All my former doubts vanished as though ice had melted away. In a loud voice I called, "Wonderful! Wonderful! There is no cycle of birth and death through which one must pass. There is no enlightenment one must seek. The 1700 koans handed down from the past have not the slightest value whatsoever." Does that sound familiar? From our previous Taishos, where he was denouncing those who thought this way. My pride soared up like a majestic mountain. My arrogance surged forward like the tide. smugly, I thought to myself, in the past 200 or 300 years, no one could have accomplished such a marvelous breakthrough as this. Shouldering my glorious enlightenment, I set out at once for Shinano, where he called on a master Shoju. I told him of my experience and presented him with a verse. The master, holding my verse up in his left hand, said to me, "This verse is what you have learned from study. Now show me what your intuition has to say." And he held out his right hand. I replied, "If there were something intuitive that I could show you, I'd vomit it out." And I made a gagging sound. The master said, "How do you understand Zhao Zhou's Mu?" I replied, "What sort of place does Mu have that one can attach arms and legs to it?" The master twisted my nose with his fingers and said, "Here's some place to attach arms and legs." I was nonplussed, and the master gave a hearty laugh. "You poor hole-dwelling devil," he cried. I paid him no attention, and he continued, "Do you think somehow that you have sufficient understanding?" I answered, "What do you think is missing?" Then the master began to discuss the koan that tells of Nanxuan's death. I clapped my hands over my ears and started out of the room. The master called after me, "Hey, monk!" And when I turned to him, he added, "You poor hole-dwelling devil." From then on, almost every time he saw me, the master called me a poor hole-dwelling devil. One evening, the master sat cooling himself on the veranda. Again, I brought him a verse I had written. He said, "Delusions and fancies. I shouted his words back at him in a loud voice, whereupon the master seized me and rained 20 or 30 blows with his fist on me and pushed me off the veranda. This was after a long spell of rain. I lay stretched out in the mud as though dead, scarcely breathing and almost unconscious. I could not move. Meanwhile, the master sat on the veranda roaring with laughter. After a short while, I regained consciousness, got up, and bowed to the master. My body was bathed in perspiration. The master called out to me in a loud voice, "You poor hole-dwelling devil." You know, we can hardly imagine this kind of rough treatment. But we know from what follows here that this master had a good bead on Hakuin. He knew that this was a guy, this was real material. This is a vessel of the Dharma, and that he could wail on him like this, and he would prevail. He would see his way through it, and he would respond to the challenge. After this, I devoted myself to an intensive investigation of the koan on the death of Nanxuan, not pausing to sleep or eat. Nanxuan is a nonsense in Japanese. One day, I had a kind of awakening and went to the master's room to test my understanding, but he would not approve it. All he did was call me, "All together now, a poor hole-dwelling devil." I began to think that I had better leave and go somewhere else. One day, when I had gone to town to beg for food, I encountered a madman who tried to beat me with a broom. Unexpectedly, I found that I had penetrated the koan on the death of Nan Xuan. Then the other koans that had puzzled me, Sushan's memorial tower and Da Wei's verse on the roundness of the lotus leaf, fell into place of themselves, and I penetrated them all. After our return to the temple, I spoke of the understanding I had gained. The master neither approved nor denied what I said, but only laughed pleasantly. But from this time on, he stopped calling me a poor hole-dwelling devil. Later, I experienced enlightenment two or three times, accompanied by a great feeling of joy. At times there are words to express such experiences, but to my regret, at other times, there are none. It was as though I were walking about in the shadow cast by a lantern. I returned then and attended on my old teacher who had fallen ill. This was a previous teacher, not the one he was just been working with. One day I read in the verse given by Shi Kong to his disciple as they were parting this passage. As we go to part, a tall bamboo stands by the gate. Its leaves stir the clear breeze for you in farewell. I was overcome with a great joy, as though a dark path had suddenly been illumined. Unconsciously, I cried aloud, "Today, for the first time, I have entered into the samadhi of words." I arose and bowed in reverence. After this, I set out on a pilgrimage. One day, when I was passing through southern Ise, I ran into a downpour and the waters reached to my knees. Suddenly, I gained an even deeper understanding of the verse on the roundness of the lotus leaf by Da Wei. I was unable to contain my joy. I lost all awareness of my body, fell headlong into the waters, and forgot completely to get up again. My bundles and clothing were soaked through. Fortunately, a passerby, seeing my predicament, helped me to get up. I roared with laughter, and everyone there thought I was mad. That winter, when I was sitting at night in the monk's hall, I gained an enlightenment from the sound of snow falling. The next year, while practicing walking meditation at the monk's hall, I suddenly had an enlightenment experience greater than any I had had before, and was overcome by a great surge of joy. And then he describes a dream. I think I won't go into that. Later, I happened to read the P.N. Lu again. It's the Blue Cliff record, I think. And my understanding of it differed completely from what it had been before. One night after, some time after, I took up the Lotus Sutra. Suddenly, I penetrated to the perfect, true, ultimate meaning of the lotus. The doubts I had held initially were destroyed, and I became aware that the understanding I had obtained up to then was greatly in error. Unconsciously, I uttered a great cry and burst into tears. This is how it is when we have these openings in our practice. Each each one seems to be a kind of crowning experience. Ah, now I get it. Before, that wasn't it. This is it now. And then later we find out that this wasn't it either. And we think that is it. He goes on, I wish that everyone would realize that practicing Zen under a teacher is not such a simple matter after all. Although I am old and dissipated and have nothing of which I can be proud, I am aware that at least I have not spent 40 years in vain. This is typical Japanese self-effacement. Was it not for this reason that Chang Wu let go of his gold, that's Layman Pong, and engaged in his painful struggles toward success? As in the example I gave you, if you shoulder the one-sided understanding you have gained and spend your whole life vainly polishing and purifying it, how are you any different from Layman Pong, who guarded his piece of gold throughout his life, starving himself and bringing only harm to his body? Maybe that's not Layman Pong. Layman Pong was this great enlightened layman who was famous for having dumped his treasure of gold into the river, but this seems to be a different thing. In India, such a person is called a poor son of a rich man. In China, he is spoken of as belonging to the group that practices the heretical silent illumination Zen. None of these knows the dignity of the Bodhisattva, nor does he reach the understanding that illuminates the cause for entrance to a Buddha land. Nowadays, people go about carrying on their shoulders a single empty principle, and with it, quote, understand the Buddha, understand the patriarchs, understand the old koans. Then they all say, like the stick, like the dharani, like the kotsu. How laughable this is. Exert yourselves, students, for the Buddha way is deep and far. Let everyone know that the farther you enter the sea, the deeper it becomes, and the higher you climb a mountain, the taller it gets. He's referring here, of course, to the Dharma. And now the chapter is called Ora Te Gama, Part 1. And this is a letter, an actual letter that Hakuin wrote in reply to a governor of a province. Yesterday I received your letter delivered to me from afar. It must be a great relief to have successfully brought to a finish your entertainment of the Koreans. And he goes on with, thank you for inquiring about my health. I'm well as usual. You need not worry about me. I was most pleased to hear that you are devoting yourself unceasingly to koan meditation in both its active and quietistic aspects. As for the other matters you touch upon in your letter, I find myself in complete agreement. You cannot imagine how delighted I am at your many accomplishments. And then, if their motivation is bad, virtually all Zen practitioners find themselves blocked in both the active and quietistic approaches to their practice of koan meditation. They fall into a state of severe depression and distraction. The fire mounts to the heart. The metal element in the lungs shrinks painfully. The health generally declines, and quite frequently they develop an illness most difficult to cure. Yet if they polish and perfect themselves in the true practice of introspection, they will conform to the secret methods for the ultimate nourishment. Their bodies and minds will become strong, their vitality great, and they will readily attain to enlightenment in all things. Shakyamuni Buddha taught this point in detail Master Chi Yi of such and such has made them available to us in such and such a book. The essential point brought out in this book is that whether reading certain parts of the sacred teachings, whether examining the principles of the Dharma, whether sitting for long periods without lying down, or whether engaged in walking practices throughout the six divisions of the day, the vital breath must always be made to fill the space between the navel and the loins. Even though one may be hemmed in by worldly cares or tied down by guests who require elaborate attention, the source of strength 2 inches below the navel must naturally be filled with the vital breath, and at no time may it be allowed to disperse. He's talking about not just the hara, but the tanden. The hara is just generally the whole area around the midsection, whereas the tanden is that point. We usually say it's the width of 3 or 4 fingers below the navel. This area should be pendulous and well-rounded, somewhat like a new ball that is yet to be used. If a person is able to acquire this kind of breath concentration, he can sit in meditation all day long without it ever tiring him. He can recite sutras from morning to night without becoming worn out. He can write all day long without any trouble. He can talk all day without collapsing from fatigue. Even if he practices good works day after day, there will still be no indications of flagging. In fact, the capacity of his mind will gradually grow larger and his vitality will always be strong. And he goes on. The Moho Chikwan speaks of the tentative and the empty tranquilization. The method of introspection that I describe here represents the essentials of this tentative tranquilization. When I was young, the content of my koan meditation was poor. I was convinced that absolute tranquility of the source of the mind was the Buddha way. Thus I despised activity and was fond of quietude. I would always seek out some dark and gloomy place and engage in dead sitting. Trivial and mundane matters pressed against my chest and a fire mounted in my heart. I was unable to enter wholeheartedly into the active practice of Zen. My manner became irascible and fears assailed me. My mind was in a continual state of depression, and I made not the slightest advance toward gaining the benefits that result from the practice of Buddhism. Frequently, you may feel that you are getting nowhere with practice in the midst of activity, whereas the quietistic approach brings unexpected results. Yet rest assured that those who use the quietistic approach can never hope to enter into meditation in the midst of activity. Should by chance a person who uses this approach enter into the dusts and confusions of the world of activity, even the power of ordinary understanding, which he had seemingly attained, will be entirely lost. Drained of all vitality, he will be inferior to any mediocre, talentless person. The most trivial matters will upset him, and inordinate cowardice will afflict his mind, and he will frequently behave in a mean and base manner. What can you call accomplished about a man like this? He's touching here on an issue that has concerned an awful lot of us, which is how to integrate our sitting practice into our daily life. It is difficult. It is difficult, but we can't say that we have a mature practice until we manage to, some degree, to do this, to maintain our center in the midst of activity. And he goes on, speaking of this, he quotes the master Da Wei, who had said that meditation in the midst of activity is immeasurably superior to the quietistic approach. Po Shan, another Chinese master, has said that if one does not attain to this meditation within activity, one's practice is like trying to cross a mountain ridge as narrow as a sheep's skull with 120-pound load on one's back. I am not trying to tell you to discard completely quietistic meditation and to seek specifically for a place of activity in which to carry out your practice. What is most worthy of respect is a pure koan meditation that neither knows nor is conscious of the two aspects, the quiet and the active. This is why it has been said that the true practicing monk walks but does not know he is walking, sits but does not know he is sitting. For penetrating to the depths of one's own true self-nature and for attaining a vitality valid on all occasions, nothing can surpass meditation in the midst of activity. Supposing that you owned several hundred ryo of gold and you wanted to hire someone to guard it, one candidate shuts up the room, seals the door, and just sits there. True, he does not allow the money to be stolen, but the method he adopts does not allow him to be a man with much vitality. His practice may best be compared with that of the Hinayana follower who is intent only on his own personal enlightenment. Now suppose that there is another candidate. He is ordered to take this money and to deliver it to such and such a place, although the road he must take is infested with thieves and evil men who swarm like bees and ants. Courageously he ties a large sword to his waist, tucks up the hem of his robes, and fastening the gold to the end of a staff, sets out at once and delivers the money to the appointed place without once having trouble with the thieves. Indeed, such a one must be praised as a noble figure who, without the slightest sign of fear, acts with forthrightness and courage. His attitude may be compared to that of the perfect bodhisattva who, while striving for his own enlightenment, helps to guide all sentient beings. The several hundred ryo of gold spoken of here stand for the great resolve to carry out the true, steadfast, unretrogressing meditation practice. The thieves and evil men swarming like bees and ants represent the delusions of the five coverings, the 10 bonds, the 5 desires, and the 8 wrong views. I'll just tick these off because I think one or two of us may be able to relate to these. The 5 coverings are desire, anger, sleepiness, excitability, and doubt. This is probably, what is elsewhere is called the 5 hindrances. And then the 10 bonds are those that tie man so that he cannot escape from birth and death. They are lack of shame, lack of conscience, envy, stinginess, timidity, sleepiness, busyness, absorption, anger, and secretiveness. The 5 desires are wealth, sex, food, fame, sleep. And the 8 wrong views, it's too complicated, I won't read that one. Such and such a place refers to the treasure place of the great peaceful nirvana, endowed with the 4 virtues of permanence, peace, self, and purity. That's what we chant in the Kanongyo, eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. These are said to be the 4 qualities of nirvana. For these reasons, it is said that the monk who is truly practicing Zen must carry on his activity in the midst of the phenomenal world. The 3rd patriarch has said, and this is Sangsan in our Affirming Faith in Mind, if one wishes to gain true intimacy with enlightenment, one must not shun the objects of the senses. It's obviously a different translation than the chanting version that we do. He does not mean here that one is to delight in the objects of the senses, but just as the wings of a waterfowl do not get wet even when it enters the water, one must establish a mind that will continue a true koan meditation without interruption, neither clinging to nor rejecting the objects of the senses. Neither clinging to nor rejecting the objects of the senses. A person who fanatically avoids the objects of the senses and dreads the 8 winds that stimulate the passions unconsciously falls into the pit of the Hinayana and never will be able to achieve the Buddha way. The 8 winds are, and these are the 8 winds that stir the passions. These are gain and loss, praise and censure, I was trying to use these in the way we usually say them. I'll just read them as it says. Gain and loss, slander, eulogy, praise, ridicule, pain, and pleasure. Yung Chia has said, the power, this is another great Chinese master, the power of the wisdom attained by practicing meditation in the world of desire is like the lotus that rises from fire. It can never be destroyed. Here again, Yung Chia does not mean that one should sink into the world of the 5 desires. What he is saying is that even though one is in the midst of the 5 desires and the objects of the senses, one must be possessed of a mind receptive to purity, as the lotus is unstained by the mud from which it grows. Bear in mind here that Hakuin is writing to a layman. He's writing to this governor of a province. And so what he would want to emphasize is the importance of carrying on the practice outside a monastery, in daily life. And that is something that all of us can appreciate, is the challenge of that and the importance of doing it. One more paragraph. Moreover, even should you live in the forest or the wilderness, eat one meal a day and practice the way both day and night, it is still difficult to devote yourself to purity in your works. How much harder must it be then for one who lives with his wife and relatives amid the dusts and turmoils of this busy life? But if you do not have the eye to see into your own nature, you will not have the slightest chance of being responsive to the teaching. Therefore, Bodhidharma has said, if you wish to attain the Buddha way, you must first see into your own nature. And that's all the time we have. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.